Your SteveJonesShow.com audio is loading. SteveJonesShow.com audio is sponsored by Rick Weibel at REW Insurance and Financial Services, LLC. Call them at 800-609-9484 or visit them online at REWfinancial.com.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome to the Thursday edition of the Steve Jones Show. Steve joining us from the Sunbury Motors Studio in just a few moments, taking your questions on the Lenape Solar Hotline, 1-800-795-9565. That's 1-800-795-9565. At SteveJonesShow.com today, well, and it's been there for a couple of days, we put up our poll question, and our poll question has to do with how many wins you think the Nittany Lions will get in the upcoming season. We have picked the number of 8 as being the starting place. So will Penn State win 8 or more games this season? So go mobile version of it as well. Steve Jones started playing camp before kicking it. In the middle of football season, the high school teams have gotten their practices underway. Looking at day number 3 there, this is where they start to really get everybody in the position they think they're going to be in, getting ready for a weekend scrimmage. And a lot of the teams will have a scrimmage either Friday night or Saturday somewhere, whether it be home away. And then they'll have another scrimmage at high school level coming up on Friday, Saturday of next week, getting ready for the season opener on August the 31st. Is that right? August 31st? Is that the next Friday? Yeah, August 31st. I can't believe we're over halfway through August already. Anyway, so we talk high school football. We'll talk a little Steeler football. We'll talk Olympics, and of course, we'll have a lot of other topics, and you can pick the topic, too, at 1-800-795-9565. Email SteveJones at WKOK.com, and our Facebook page is always available, too, Steve Jones Show on...
Nobody wants to hear you.
And just as I start to bring up a topic, you come in. You were just sitting there waiting for me to start a topic so you could drop it out.
I've been lurking for 2 minutes.
Well,
go ahead, bring it up.
This is something that's near and dear to my heart, youth
all
football.
Right. Olympics, Mike Wallace.
No.
We're going to be talking about both today, by the way.
I know that. No, this is in regards to youth football. Now, we've had discussions about youth football a lot on this program regarding concussions. But there is a youth league in Texas that is banning a young man who is actually 12, but he is a seventh grader that is right around 300 pounds. So according to their rule book, he's 135 pounds, or 135 pounds is the cutoff. So he would not be able to play. Now, there's a lot of leagues that have this rule. Is that a good rule to have? Is that actually doing what it's supposed to do? It's set in there to keep younger, smaller players safe, but it also keeps bigger players from having an opportunity to play at the youth level instead of jumping right into the junior high level a little early. And this particular player has never played football before, so he'd be jumping into a junior high level right away without any experience whatsoever. At seventh, most youth football programs, if you're a seventh grader, you have the option whether you want to go to junior high or go to the youth program, which is the way it is around most of the leagues here. And also, several of the leagues do have a weight limit, whether it be 125 pounds.
How old is he, 12 years old?
He's 12. 135, 125 pounds, right. That's usually the weight limit. My thought on this is, I don't really have a problem with a player who is a little heavier going on the line. I don't necessarily think he should be a running back, but I have no problems with a bigger player going on the line of scrimmage. Not only does it give him an opportunity to play football, but let's face it, it gets him an opportunity to, you know, help get into better shape. Are we sending the wrong message by putting a weight limit on it for the right reason?
Well,
that's a good question, isn't it?
I would think that for games, you have to adhere to the weight limit. I think if you're a league and you want a guy to be allowed to practice so he can learn the skills and at the same time maybe drop weight, okay, then should be allowed to practice. But when it comes to the playing, the 135-pound rule for 12-year-olds is a good rule.
I'm mixed about it. I really am. I don't mind him being on the line because I think that you can. It's a great opportunity to teach a younger player how to be faster and take advantage of a bigger player being naturally a little bit slower.
So I would. By the way, State College or High School has banned all Penn State clothing on their campus. By the way,
that's not real, is it?
They're not going to allow it. So, and wow. my daughter just showed it to me. So,
wow.
I think the 135-pound limit for youth football is a good idea. There should be no weight limit when it comes to junior high.
No, I agree.
I think that if that young person wants to join, learn skills, first of all, I would not say, hey, you have to pay at a full rate because you're not playing in games. But to get them out there, get them exercising, get them moving around, getting them to learn fundamentals and things like that, I'm all for that, but not playing in the games because I think the 135-pound limit up to the age of 12 is proper because you're still developing bodies at that point. Bones are not fully developed. Muscle not fully developed. So I think there are a lot of positive, a lot of good reasons why. I'm not a big youth football proponent anyway.
No, I know.
I do not think football should start until you get to sixth grade.
And to be honest, as somebody that coaches youth football all the way down to the 8-year-old level, again, I have mixed emotions. I'm kind of on the fence on that one as well. I've seen the benefits, and I've also seen the negatives of it. I know what the difference is between an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old being at the same level, which is why, you know, on the group that I help with, we try not to put younger players in with the bigger kids at the 10-year-old level, unless we feel that player is physically and mentally ready to make that jump. We actually, the league that I'm involved in actually has 8- and 9-year-old games where the playing field's much more level, and you have an opportunity to get those kids a little more experience on an even playing field.
All right, and I understand all that. I'm just saying I've never been for, even when I was growing up, I didn't think it was such a great idea, to be honest with you.
But I understand that. I understand that side of the argument.
But I
also don't want to sit there and tell a kid that obviously wants to play football, that has the desire to play football, I'm sorry, you can't play football because you don't fit into a weight limit.
Well, that's why I say you should be allowed to practice but not play. I think when it comes to the actual game itself, in other words, look, we'll get you out there. We'll teach you fundamentals and so forth. You know, a reduced rate. You know, we hate to tell you that there's a weight limit in the league, but at the same time, it's good to get you out there moving around. I said, learning skills and so forth, and down the road, it's going to help you. But the 135-pound, there's a reason the 135-pound weight limit's been put in, and I think it should be respected. Again, but for me, I don't think it's, except unless it's a skills camp, I don't think games should be played 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. They're still in the development stage with their bodies. Baseball doesn't tax you because of the contact the way football does. It just doesn't.
No, you're right.
And I think it's different. I mean, that's why having 8, 9, 10-year-old playing basketball, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old playing baseball, yeah, even, you know, and of course hockey because of the skating skills and things like that, that's fine too. Pee-wee midget hockey and so forth. But when it comes to football, it's too much banging around, knocking around, landing on and things like that at that particular age. And I think if you start in junior high school, I think that's where you can start teaching the proper skills and also start with the team concept. I think you become, especially the maturity part of it, old enough to handle it.
Well, I would agree with you on everything, but I'm not quite sure if I'm with you on the hockey part of it. There's hockey, an awful lot of contact in hockey.
Yeah, but that's skating, and that's all. There's also a lot of plays with no contact in hockey.
True.
On football, everybody's in contact.
Well, it's controlled collisions. That's what football is.
You know, there's contact all the time. So, that's the one I object to. I just think that you're so young that when you start at junior high, it's just my opinion, you start at junior high, I think that's the right time to start.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with the idea of not necessarily playing in games and making sure to play in practice, but it's really tough to tell a player that works his tail off like that, you know, this is great, you're doing well in practice, but I'm sorry, I can't play in a game where everybody else is.
But there are league rules, too. All right.
It is a league rule, and that's the way and the rule is in there. I'm not saying that the rule should be superseded for this particular instance. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just questioning whether that rule serves the right purpose. The intent is to keep players safe, but on the other side of it, it also eliminates the opportunity from players who want to play that probably could use the exercise. And I'm not being rude. I'm just saying they could use the exercise, but it bans them from being able to do that.
I understand all that. But again, I am in no way putting down youth football. In no way. Am I in no way putting down youth football coaching? I'm saying my preference would be is that they should start in sixth grade. I'm not a doctor, not a coach, just somebody who's observed things for 30-something years. And that's how I look at it.
Well, you're right. There is a big developmental difference at that age, and it could be a huge gap, both mentally and physically, at the 8, 9, 10, 11, even in 12-year-olds.
So, I mean, that's how I look at it, and which would eliminate the idea of 135 pounds and 300.
That would eliminate the issue. You're right.
So, I mean, that's how I look at it. Our number is 1-800. So now, if you think I'm wrong, that's fine. You can call up right now and tell me I'm wrong. And I'm more than willing to listen.
But I think this brings up an interesting conversation on all sides. You know, on the let's get our kids healthy side, on the let's keep our kids active, on the is this the right sport for this level or for this age group. I think this opens the door to a lot of different conversations.
Oh yeah, I think it does too. I'm just thinking the developmental safety part of it. I think obviously the hit of a 135 pounder is relative to the, you know, in terms of age and size as opposed to somebody 300 hitting an adult. But at the same time, you're also talking about people whose bones, bodies are not fully developed yet. That's the part that I'm concerned about.
No, but I've also seen 135-pound kids lay out a pretty good hit that you don't see at many high school games either. So, you know, and that's part, as you said, that's part of the developmental and where everybody is, you know, because each kid's different.
So, I mean, that's how I look at it. Coming up, Jeff Lowe. He'll be on the show to give Kevin his Olympic fix.
I keep telling myself it's not over. It's not over.
I can most assuredly tell you it's over. And then just after 4, Tim Benz, and we're going to update you on the Mike Wallace situation.
Better have good news.
Then don't listen.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Look, he's not there. He thinks he's Larry Fitzgerald.
Listen, I have 4 words for him, and I hope he's listening somewhere. Get your butt there, period.
Not going to happen.
I know.
Our number, 1-800-795-9565. Today's show being brought to you by Rick Weibel at REW Insurance and Financial Services, LLC. We'll come back with more on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza is having their River Fest of Savings. Choose from over 200 pre-owned vehicles at one location, and they all come with Sunbury Motors' lowest price promise. Sunbury Motors researches the market and makes sure their prices are the lowest of any like vehicle from a franchise dealer within a 50-mile radius. Pick from 15 pre-owned Escapes starting at $12,943. Choose from 13 Ford Focuses as low as $96,21. Sunbury Motors has one of the largest selections of used trucks in Central PA. Browse through over 30 F-150s, including a King Ranch 4x4 crew cab for only $13,563. SMC has 25 pre-owned Hyundais with Accents, Elantras, Sonatas, and Santa Fes in stock for immediate delivery. Sunbury Motors has every vehicle clearly marked with our lowest price promise. So hurry in to Sunbury Motors during River Fest of Savings. SMC in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza and at sunburymotors.com. Proudly serving the Susquehanna Valley since 1915.
Hi, I'm Rick Weibel from REW Financial. I strive to take an eagle-eye approach to your financial future to help give you the freedom to make powerful decisions. I work with you to help you find the discipline you need to get the results you want. I don't believe in just setting it up and letting things go. I'll always be looking to see how we can make things better. REW Financial is an independent company committed to the highest standards of integrity, ethics, and value throughout your financial journey. See us in Lewisburg and Brook Park Farm. Call 800-609-9484 or visit us online at rewfinancial.com.
Welcome back. Great to have you with us. Today's show, by the way, is being brought to you by Rick Weibel at REW Insurance and Financial Services, LLC. Call 800-609-9484. Visit online at rewfinancial.com. Phone lines open at 1-800-795-9565 on the Lenape Solar Hotline. Powered by Lenape Solar, go to lenapesolar.com. And, of course, we're in the beautiful Sunbury Motors studio, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. We'll be talking with Jeff Lowe about the Olympics, 335. 4:06, we go to Tim Benz in Pittsburgh to talk about the Mike Wallace situation with the Steelers. These two segments were done with you in mind.
Thank you. I've been waiting all week for these two segments.
Where's Bartlett? Our number is 1-800-795-9565, 1-800-795-9565. If you'd like to jump in, I'd love to hear your opinion, by the way, about the youth football issue. There's certainly a lot of people out there that coach are getting involved in youth football. I mean, it's not much of an issue to me. I'm saying my recommendation would be, there's nothing against the kids and nothing against the coaches. I just would start later, that's all.
And that's fine. Now, my son played from 8 years old. I coach younger level 8, and I've coached 12s. I see the points that are always made, and I see the points you're making. I just think there's more benefit than there is risk. And I'm not completely convinced that the football risk outweighs the risk on many sports. I see the football risk as being really not that much more than a soccer risk. That's just me. I could be wrong.
The soccer risk?
Sure.
I mean, there's some tackling in soccer, but most youth soccer leagues, it's guppy ball.
And most 8-year-old football leagues are pretty lenient when it comes to the hits.
Ball's over there, all little guppies run to the ball. I got it. I know, I mean... I coached youth baseball for 14 years, many a day. Mike, don't pick the dandelions. Sorry. don't pick the clover. Okay, so just be alert. The ball may be hit to you. I don't want you to get hurt, Mike.
Well, it's no different in football. I mean, the attention span of a gnat every now and then. So, but that's just part of being that age.
Well, exactly right. And you know, so I do understand that. But once they get to be about 11 or 12, they can bang around pretty good. And they're not quite fully developed yet. I mean, something in soccer can happen, but it's more fluky and freaky. When you're talking about football, there's contact, and it's deliberate contact on every play. I mean, you don't have a lot of deliberate contact in soccer. But in football, you deliberately have to have contact on every play.
But you have to remember, when you played football, they've changed the helmets a little bit since then. They're not using leather anymore. There's a face mask in front of it. And they actually do have full padding now.
I didn't play football until I got to high school.
Like I said. They have face masks now.
I see. So when I have Peter King from NBC on the show, are you going to tell him the same thing?
Yeah. I don't know. It depends on how I feel that day.
You know, he and I played the same team.
I do remember you saying that.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's older. By a year. Sarah in the news, the only person on this program that makes any sense. Then Jeff Lowe on the Olympics because Kevin needs his fix.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
One thing I've been very concerned about the last few days is Kevin going into withdrawal over the Olympics.
I just keep watching the repeats on NBC Sports Network and I'm good.
Well, we're going to go back to a guy that we talked to in London, Jeff Lowe from Dial Global Radio, who joined us from London during the Olympics games, and it's going to be great to have Jeff back on the show. Jeff, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on again.
All right. The experience of it. You try to grow from every experience that you go through. What were some of the things of that you picked up in those 17 days where they'll stick with you forever?
I think it's hard to narrow down just one thing. I think it's emotion. It's figuring out how to control emotion when you're covering that, how to react to emotion of the people you're covering, whether it's, you know, interviewing a 16-year-old gymnast that is crying because she just, you know, just had her dreams crushed, or whether it's you just staying calm in a press box when, for example, you're at Team USA basketball, you see LeBron James take off from the free throw line, throw a dunk down, and you can't react, even though it's your country, but all the other countries around you are standing up and, you know, going absolutely crazy. So it's about controlling emotion and reacting to it. It was unreal to see, and you learn a lot the first time you go.
Was there an event along the way that you covered that surprised you that you ended up enjoying it?
Shooting, plain and simple. I went to shooting probably 5 times. I saw 3 gold medals from the United States. It is, you almost feel nervous for them because all it takes is that split second that they shoot. That's all their competition is a few split seconds, and there's so much emotion in that, too. I mean, they care so much about that, and the littlest, I mean, talk about margin of error. There is no margin of error in that sport. The smallest of centimeters, you can go from gold to losing. So it was fun to watch, and the venue there was really nice.
Was there a disappointment along the way?
Disappointment? I mean, disappointment in terms of what I didn't get to see. I didn't get to see indoor volleyball. But in terms of disappointment of seeing something, I wish Ryan Lochte would have performed better. I was kind of disappointed in some of the races I saw from him. I was disappointed Lolo Jones didn't take away a medal in hurdles. But otherwise, I mean, there was nothing I really can complain about. It was, I mean, I guess the food maybe at times was a little poor. But, you know, you have to, the media village was unreal. So I really can't complain about that.
No, I don't think you can at all. When you look at the atmosphere of the games, the atmosphere in Beijing was everyone tread lightly, be as nice as possible, say as many nice things about the host country as possible, make sure you're looking left and right the entire time, and make sure that the trip back to the airport is successfully executed. What was the atmosphere like in London?
It was very, very relaxed. I mean, well, it's tough to say relaxed. You see people walking around with guns, but for how big of a, how high the security was, it was very relaxed. And everyone that was in Beijing said that Beijing was great, but it was very robotic because there was it was a mission to succeed from Beijing. In London, they were happy. They enjoyed everything. They, whether it was their athletes, other countries' athletes, or just interacting with you, so many people just wanted to stop and talk to you and find out your story, and you wanted to find out their story. It was just very enjoyable. And honestly, the biggest thing going into it was how was the weather going to be, and it was perfect. The fact that it rained only, I think there was only one day where it affected anything, and I sat under an umbrella one time out of the entire Olympic Games. So that was just, that was perfect. The weather was outstanding. I think that helped their moods, but overall they were such gracious hosts, and I'm sure they would love to do it again.
Well, it's the third time they've had them, so it's going to be a while before they do it again. I can tell you that.
Probably.
It's the third time through. They usually wait a while until they give you the Olympics a fourth time. But what about the way the venues were laid out? Was it easily accessible for fans and media to move seamlessly from one to the other, or were there some, you know, Atlanta, for example, had transportation issues. What about this?
There were no transportation issues. Well, actually, well, I say that with the disclaimer. There was an accident with a bus and a cyclist. That was the only thing, and that was all, you know, not too much to do with the games other than just, you know, an incident, a legal incident. But otherwise, the transportation was great. You know, Steve, you work with a lot of sports writers. You know, sometimes media, we can be a little, I guess, complainy sometimes. Some people were like, ah, well, they're far away. But honestly, in the end, everyone admitted, they're like, this has been outstanding. Because the farthest away event, like legit event, I think was volleyball. And that was about an hour outside. You have to go to Earl's Court in downtown London. Other than that, I mean, you expect canoeing and kayaking to be farther away. That's how it usually works. But I'll tell you, especially compared to the layout we've seen for Rio, and I hope it's successful games, but they have three zones of different events, and all the zones are within an hour away from each other. So if you're going to the ceremonies or you're going to track and field and you're at the village where the athletes are, if you're at the media center, you're going to have to drive an hour or take an hour-long train, which currently does not exist yet. So London did a great job with transportation. They knew what to expect. And honestly, the people there, they adjusted very well. There were no issues transportation-wise.
If there is a stereotype of the British fan, and part of that comes from the fact that we watch a lot of tennis at Wimbledon and we watch a lot of golf at St. Andrews and, of course, the British Open itself, is that they are, quote, stoic. Yet in this, we saw an outpouring of emotion. Were you surprised by it? Were those covering it surprised by it?
I think a lot of people expected the soccer mentality, just the really, you know, in your face, loud, rowdy. I mean, they were loud, but I think you nailed it there. They were emotional. It was just something different for them. And I think a lot of people didn't expect them to place third in the medals count. And I think they had a feeling themselves they could, and they saw all their big stories from Jessica Ennis to Mo Farah. The only one who didn't succeed if they had a lot of pressure was their triple jumper, Philip Zadeau. But Jessica Ennis, and I was there when she won the heptathlon. It was just fun. You know, I think everyone almost teared up because there was, it's kind of proving people wrong. It proved to everyone that they were here in the game, not just post them, but to compete and really contend for one of the top spots in the medal stand. And they were, I think you're right, they were more emotional than they were anything else.
There have been a lot of stories about over the last couple of years about how British society has changed. What did it mean for Mo Farah to not only win but be cheered the way he was?
Oh, I think it was great to see. I think it was outstanding. It didn't matter, you know, who he was, where he came from. You know, he was on the front of a religious magazine, actually, in the bottom of the press center. And I think people, it was nothing about the fact he was just part of Great Britain. He was part of Team GB, and people just loved it. And honestly, the best thing about what he did was, Mo Farah is great, Jessica Ennis is great, Usain Bolt was the biggest star at these Olympics. And if you're colorblind and never and didn't know where Usain Bolt was from, you saw him, you would think he was at a Team GB athlete. You wouldn't see the green and yellow Jamaica thing on him because it's unreal. I think if he was paired up against a Team GB athlete, they would have still cheered for Usain better. So Usain Bolt and Mo Farah together on that track, running around and doing each other's celebrations, that was unbelievable to see. It was like Bolt had become part of Team GP. He had different colors, and him and Farah were just, they were outstanding. It was really captivating the crowd.
The Bolt part of it, he's not shy to tell you that he thinks he's not that bad. But how well, you know, in the British tabloids, how well did it play?
Oh, he was, I tell you, I took a picture of the magazine and newspaper stand we had in the press center. And not just the British papers, it was all of the British papers. The same day that they had a few gold medals, he was on the front page. He wasn't a GB athlete, it was Usain Bolt. And he just, they love it. It's not even a fact that he's cocky, that he wins a lot. It's the fact that when he is cocky, he runs around the track and he interacts with fans. He loves talking to fans. He loves being a part of it. And I don't know if the whole soccer thing and his whole love for soccer plays into it, and that's one big reason why he loves London so much, but he loves the city. And people know that, and he embraces it. He's not an athlete going out there winning, celebrating for himself, then leaving. He doesn't go down to the media zone for interviews until like an hour after the race because he loves hanging around on the track and interacting with fans. And that, you know, so many people complained about it, but in the end, he's there for the fans, for the country, and he did an outstanding job. It surprised me. I didn't really understand if he was cocky, but accepting of the fans, and he really was.
Is part of all this act that he has, and I'll refer to it as an act, and the fact that he interacts with the fans the way he does, is that part and parcel because he didn't win the Jamaican Olympic trials? And people did doubt him. Was it actually him, you know, almost an act of appreciation? Like, hey, you know, I appreciate you as much and maybe the sport even more so because I'm back on top?
You know, I don't know. And it was tough to get a real sense. I think that could be a little bit of it. I've talked to some of the Jamaican writers and one of the coaches, actually, who said that he wasn't worried about these Olympics because he wasn't healthy against Johan Blake in the trials. And that, you know, he was just going to keep quiet. He's saying, you know, I'm ready. I'm going to be ready to go for the Olympics. I'm going to win. And I guess it was the confidence was justified. But I do know, I get what you're saying. And I think that could be a bit of it. You know, he could have played a role. The fact that I personally thought, and I'll admit, I didn't think he was going to succeed these games. I didn't think the injury was a real issue. I thought he just was not as good as he used to be. And boy, was I very wrong. And I was glad I was wrong because he put on a heck of a show. But you know, I think I think some of it is all mixed together there for why he was so accepting.
Let's talk for a moment about Dial Global, part of Westwood. When they put together an endeavor like this, there's so much to cover along the way. Give us an idea of the organization within Dial Global that allows it to seem so seamless to those of us who listen.
Well, I think it all starts with the fact that, you know, they work with NBC for the Olympics, and I got to see, you know, kind of helping out there, working for Team USA too, and just kind of see how it all works. And it's an interaction with the IOC, it's interaction with, you know, with Team USA, and it's an interaction with the athletes too. And they cover so many sports, and it's tougher for radio too because I think a lot of people don't understand this too. For TV, and this is the same for the World Cup, there's one set of cameras. Now NBC gets to pick a few shots here and there, but there's one set of cameras. So that work is done by the Olympic Broadcasting Service. For the radio, it's not as easy. So it's about, you know, figuring out how to play, you know, an event via radio. And it's not easy, but, you know, Dial Global, formerly Westwood One, does a heck of a job at getting that, you know, produced on air and allowing people to really get into gymnastics on the radio. That doesn't seem like a very easy thing to do. So it's about, you know, it's about experience. That's a big reason why them getting the Olympics back, Dial Global and NBC, is a big deal because they have the experience of broadcasting an Olympics and they know what the curveball is thrown at you might be, or you know what kind of corners you might have to turn to make something play better on air. So that's a big part of it too.
Should you get to go to Rio, and I'm sure that's a goal within mm-hmm. you that to get an opportunity in 2016 to go there, what might you do differently personally this time and how you cover it? That you learned from 17 days in London?
That's tough. I guess the next one is going to be about pacing yourself because these Olympics were easy because everything was so close. And I had a little more free rein because I was, you know, more on the intern side of it. I wasn't exactly a hired employee. I didn't get any bonuses because they were on top of the medal stand. I was able to, you know, kind of allow myself to make my own schedule at times. But I think in Rio with transportation, this goes for everyone. To me, about pacing yourself, because if you do have to get to athletics, you're not going to be able to cut it close because, you know, you got to ride a train that might not exist. But if it does, it's going to take about an hour to get through there. and get to athletics, then get back to the press center. And it's about time management, I guess, is the best way to put it. You gotta manage your time at the Olympics because it's moving so fast. I will say the lucky thing about Rio is the time zone will not be an issue. So that's going to help out, at least for, you know, countries in North America. That's going to help that out big time.
Talking about Usain Bolt now, intriguing. He was the subject to talk about on the women's side. Single most intriguing female athlete you interviewed and why?
Missy Franklin. Not even close. Just for someone to be 17 years old and to have so much charisma, I guess, when you talk to them. It was such a natural, but also to be so, just say the right things, but still have that 17-year-old mentality. It's mind-blowing. It's not a knock on the gymnastics girls, because I talked to all the gymnastics girls. They were emotional, but, you know, some of them had a little tougher time on, you know, camera or when you interviewed them. But Missy Franklin, I mean, it is unbelievable. And her attitude of wanting to still go to college. She saw the sponsors. She admitted she saw the sponsorship bonuses people got here. She saw the stuff that you get when you are a pro, but she still wants to go to college. And she dedicated the Olympics. You know, she's from the Aurora area to the people, the victims of the shooting. And, it, I mean, just everything was – someone in the beginning, they're like, well, I bet somebody's prepping her. But she was like that over all 17 days. And that's the amazing thing about it. And she is going to be the face of the Team USA for Rio. And she very well should be, because if she keeps the attitude she has – she's not just going to inspire the youth, which is such a big thing for the Olympics, but she's just going to captivate the United States in terms of swimming again, just like Michael Phelps did, which is a huge thing, not just for swimming, but for, you know, Team USA, USOC in general.
Michael Phelps, of course, has been the face of the sport for the past 8 years. He says emphatically he is not going to be swimming in Rio unless it's recreationally over at the interview center. But did you see something? I mean, as you mentioned, Ryan Lochte didn't have the Olympiad that some people thought he could, including himself. On the men's side, were there enough people that emerged that you feel good about the USA swimming down the road?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, it's 4 years, so it's tough. I think Nathan Adrian's one of the younger guys. He won the 100 meters by a 1/100th of a second. I think he's intriguing. I mean, Ryan Lochte's still going to be around. And personally, Ryan, in my opinion, Ryan Lochte has a lot of making up to do, because he kind of, I don't want to say he flopped. He won a, if you win a gold medal, you don't flop. But the expectations he had, he didn't quite meet them. And I think a big thing with Michael Phelps is the reason I believe he's retired is because he did so well at the end. If he hadn't won, you know, four consecutive goals to finish, I might leave it open a bit. You might want to finish out on top. But Lochte, I think, it took some heat. He had that grill, that $25,000 grill. He had all these inner videos come out about how poor he does with interviews, and I think he's got to refocus, you know, who he is and what he does on the Olympic stage, because that's not really a time to pull out a grill on the medal stand, and especially when, you know, you still got many more races left. So he has to, again, try to be a big face of U.S. swimming, because people still want to see him succeed. They just were disappointed with how he performed these Olympics.
Is there anything along the way where, you know, where the actions of a prima donna got in the way of a good interview?
Nothing that I can think about. I was fortunate enough where I think I saw a ton of really genuine people, even from the U.S. men's 4x400 relay team. Angelo Taylor, who has won multiple gold medals, he's been a big part of the 4x400 that hasn't lost since 1952, and they got silver. And he, you know, in his own eyes, he said he blew it. And he could have just blown off the cameraman. He could have blown off the reporters. And he got up there. He spoke true to his heart. He admitted defeat. He admitted that he raced poorly. And I thought that was impressive. But we didn't really see too many, I guess, you know, egos up there, especially with the men's basketball team. They are very willing. As long as you ask Coach K a smart question, you were going to get, you know, a genuine response from women's players.
Also, the Team USA basketball players, they have all the money in the world. They don't need to do this. What is it about this that drives them, that says, I want to be a part of it because it does eat up time, quote, in their summer?
It's a lot about who I think their leader is first. Well, first of all, it's about the country. And they really do truly want to play for the country. And they say it enough. And they say in a way that it's easy to believe. I think it's about the leader, too. I think Tom is a great choice in 4 years for Team USA. It's about a leader that not just captivates them as players to play for him, but who helps them learn and grow. I'd say all these players you just saw play, especially Anthony Davis, might I add that, in this tournament, they're all going to be better next year. And it's because of who they play for. They played for a coach that is going to make them reach higher, you know, reach to different levels. And they have to play different style of basketball here. And I think it's going to help them because, you know, the NBA is becoming a more international game in terms of, you know, the players that come in. I think Russell Westbrook got better. James Harden got better. They all learned things from Coach K. And I think giving them that opportunity was a huge deal. And I hope it is a Tom Izzo who coaches them in 4 years and really helps grow these players. And I think just as much as they want to represent their country, also be they want to be rock stars because that's exactly what they were when they were in London and when they were in Beijing, but they also want to become better basketball players. I think they've realized this is a great opportunity to do so, especially, and again, you know, you got their egos probably in there somewhere. It's under a, you know, a worldwide spotlight, so that's probably another big reason why as well.
Jeff, thanks so much. Appreciate the time you gave us. You did a great job over there, and we're thrilled to have had you on board with us here.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, and have a great day. Thanks so much for having me on to talk about it.
That's Jeff Lowe giving Kevin his fix on the Olympics. We'll hear from Jeff a year and a half from now in Soika.
Not Soika.
All right.
Soika's up the road a little bit.
Suet.
No. So
some Black Sea resorts.
I didn't know there was a resort in Russia either until then.
We'll have sushi then. I don't care.
I'll give it up.
All right. We're sending you. Roger and I have decided we're sending you.
Yeah, you send me the cold one.
Well, excuse me. There has to be a break-in period on something. Come on.
Send me the
Party
cold
and
one. Send me the cold one.
You can't go to the warm one. Let's go to the cold one.
I'll take that trade.
You can't go unless you go to the cold one.
Done. I'm in Russia. I'm on my way.
Now, if we can just arrange a little passport snafu. Our number, 1-800-795-9565. So we get this call. Help! Hello? Today's show being brought to you by Rick Weibel at REW Insurance and Financial Services, LLC. Call 800-609-9484 or visit online at rewfinancial.com. We're headed toward the top of the hour here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.